Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Henkel. Excellence is our passion.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 275 for February 20th of 2015. At Volkswagen, Schmidt happens. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website.
Hey, Gary.
John, how are you?
Pretty good.
Boy, I'll tell you, I got to give a shout out to Jeff Luke and the guys at GM Truck Engineering.
Why so?
I had to go to Cincinnati this week, got to Dayton, found myself in a blizzard. So I was in a canyon with a 4x4 system, and that, otherwise, I'd be like down in Cincinnati, getting an apartment, staying there. I mean, it was
the all-wheel drive got you.
It was brutal. And
that's pretty good, because sometimes pickups cannot be good in the snow just because there's no weight in the back. Or did you have anything back there?
Nothing in the back. Short box though. And but boy, it did make a magnificent job. So I was very happy. You know, high ride height. It was good to go on 75. That was
good,
great.
Good to know. And we got to let everybody know, we got Dave Zoya from Wards with us today. And great to have you on AutoLine After Hours.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me along.
And, of course, we got to get to our guest here, Oliver Schmidt. As we've been saying all week long in the promos, back by popular demand. So, Oliver, it's great to have you here.
Yeah, thanks for having me back. I couldn't believe it, but actually you got me back, yeah.
Yeah. No, we got a great reaction the last time you were here. Okay. And you're going back to Germany.
Yeah, that's great.
The end of the month.
Yes.
So I'm glad we got a window here to get you into the show.
I'm happy to come here. Enjoyed it last time, and we'll do it today.
So tell us about your period in the States, what you've been doing here, and then what you'll be doing when you go back to Germany.
What I've been doing here? Mm-hmm. I've been doing here everything emission-related. This is my main task here. So what we do in the office here is we negotiate with the agencies about upcoming regulations. We then certify every car every year, every model year. And then in the U.S., you have to do defect reporting. So you have to monitor your warranty claims for your emission-related components, report to the agencies. And you have to collect customer cars, conduct emission testing, and also report those results to both agencies, ARB and EPA. So that's what my office here does. And with this, I'm responsible for all emission compliance in the U.S. And then you have always these fleet emission calculations for your fleet average and so on. CAFE, greenhouse gas, this is what my office here does. Mm-hmm. On top of this, I have some test facilities here in the U.S., not only Detroit. We have some in New York. We have some in California, where we have workshops, where we have test teams from Germany coming over testing their cars. And we have some quality teams based there that test their cars there as a permanent customer. Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm doing here. So now going back... let's say first, I did not have any plans to go back. I already filed all my paperwork for my extension here, but then I got a call where I could only say yes or yes, please.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I dared to say yes, but. Dr. Neusser, who has two jobs within Volkswagen, he is the board member for R&D in the Volkswagen brand, and he also is the head of group powertrain development. He wants to restructure everything in the group powertrain development. So he wants to have more emphasis on group functions there and coordinate the brand better and also coordinate the related production group and the related purchasing group better. So he wants to have more coordination there. And he asked me to come over to do this job. And there's also some more ideas with more and more countries adopting emission regulation like the US or similar to the US. So the office that I led here, we need those offices now in other places in the world. So one idea is to have basically my knowledge from here and transfer it to regions like China, where we talked about this before, where we have the B6 coming up soon, which is a lot tailored to the US. We have South Korea that have American emission regulation. Taiwan is adopting more of this.
Why is that, Oliver? Because up to now, most countries have been following Europe's emission standards. Why this change to the U.S. one?
So let's be honest, U.S. emission regulations are more stringent. And the vision that the U.S. is painting is, let's say, the future is brighter there than the future that's painted in Europe. It's based on the system. Here in U.S., if you negotiate with the agencies, the agencies are those with the technical knowledge. So all your negotiations is really with the people with the technical knowledge. So they understand better what you talk about, and they look further in the future than they do in Europe. In Europe, you negotiate with politicians. And then you have all these lobbying groups. You have the lobbying group from the automotive industry. You have those from the certifying body, from German TÜV, or the equivalents in the other countries. So there, it's these negotiations are not as structured and not as straightforward as they are here in the U.S. And it seems that more and more countries realize this and think by adopting those standards that got written by technical experts, not by politicians, it's more likely that they will stay longer and that they have a more solid foundation.
So these technical experts are working for EPA?
Yeah, EPA and ARB. Uh-huh. So it's the rulemaking stuff here in Ann Arbor. It's the rulemaking stuff in Sacramento or El Monte. And they are working directly for the agency. And this is what you don't have. So in Europe, the regulations are written by politicians. They are put into a parliament and then decided in a parliament. Here in the U.S., the regulations are written by technical expert. They are put then into an NPRM in a proposed rulemaking. And then the NPRM is signed by most likely the president, and it comes into effect. There is no big voting on it.
So are the standards here more realistic than they might be in Europe or Asia?
More realistic. Which standard?
Well,
you have so many of them.
Well, I mean, so if we take the CO2, the 95 grams per 100 kilometers in Europe. Now, that was something that was basically more politically motivated than technically oriented?
No. You always have then the lobbying afterwards. But there's a lot of friction and a lot of losses in this political affairs. While here you don't have the politicians involved in the rulemaking.
Mm-hmm.
That's the big difference between them. You can't. The problem is you can't compare these regulations that much because the fleet composition here in the U.S. is totally different than the one in Europe. I did this for these negotiations with EPA for the midterm review. We did some analysis. I think in Europe, everything, including the compact segment, is more than 70% of the vehicle population, while here in the U.S., everything midsize and above is 75% of the vehicle population. So it's a totally different fleet composition. So if you now do this math and compare targets directly, you see that the 95 grams or 90 grams Europe, or 130 grams Europe, are a lot more stringent than the U.S. value. But your fleet composition is totally different.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the big issue.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned the midterm review. What's your feel for that? Do you think there'll be some backpedaling on the standards, or where do you see that going?
I that's now a personal opinion. I have the opinion it depends on who wins the next presidential election.
That's probably a very astute observation.
The first thing is, I think so Volkswagen is supporting global standards and realistic standards. We have some issues with these U.S. standards because they favor truck-heavy companies. We are not a truck-heavy company. We produce small passenger cars that are already kind of fuel efficient, so it hits us harder. And if you look in these in the curves for CAFE and greenhouse gas, you see that the stringencies for trucks, especially in the later phase, is less than the stringency for passenger cars. In passenger cars, you have an average of 5% per year. In trucks, only the small footprints have 5% per year. Then the average, the medium footprint, has 3.5, while the big footprints for 5 years have no stringency. So this is kind of our issue on this. This is why I did this comparison with fleet composition and us being a European-based brand and even in this country selling more European-like cars than American-tailored cars. This is one of our claims there. So I think the targets will not go away. They will not be revised. This 54.5 is basically cemented in stone. I think this will stand. The question is how to get there.
Is it achievable?
Of course it's achievable.
But I mean, is it achievable in a way such that John, Dave, and I can buy cars that
you can go out, buy a Prius today, and you already meet the criteria. So the question is now, do you want to drive a Prius? It's bad to use a competitor's car here now, but let's say a hybrid. So do you want to drive a hybrid with current gas prices? No, most people do not want to. We see all brands that sell hybrids see declining hybrid sales. We watch those sales, and even we within the Volkswagen brand, one of our major cornerstones is the diesel. We see dropping diesel sales. Diesel is, in comparison, is now a lot more expensive than gasoline. Gasoline engines have improved over the last year. We will talk about this later. Direct injection, downsizing, turbocharging, supercharging, whatever you put to those engines, they have improved a lot. So people are... they don't have the instant benefit for paying $4,000 or $5,000 more for a car. You don't have the instant reward anymore at the gas station. That's the big issue. The customer behavior is really the one that makes this regulation difficult. So if the regulation stays like this, brands will be forced to turn customers away and tell them, oh, no, you can't buy my big mid-size pickup truck or my big mid-size SUV at the moment. I need to sell you a hybrid sedan because I need to be compliant by the end of the model year. Mm-hmm. This is the problem, that the burden of fulfilling this regulation is entirely put on the manufacturer.
That's a big problem because with cheap gasoline prices and cheaper diesel, even though there's still a gap there between the two, consumers may not go along with what the regulations require.
Yeah, we see this. I can't give detailed numbers, but we do analysis on all of our cars, and we see a big shift towards the higher horsepower versions. Especially on Audis and Porsches, we see at the moment a move to more horsepower.
Is this, though, predicated, on the cheaper gas prices that exist right now?
Yeah.
Okay, because, so one of the things that I have in this book here,
yeah,
a study that they just did at the University of Kansas, and it was looking at window stickers. Mm. And these guys concluded, the new survey found that when labels added total cost information such as financing, depreciation, registration, maintenance, and insurance costs, consumers in the market for small to mid-sized car were more likely to choose a plug-in hybrid and battery electric vehicle. They're making the point that now people aren't getting them because of the initial upfront cost. Mm. But these guys are saying that if you wrap in all of the information of the presumed life of the vehicle, 5 years, they're saying.
I'd like to see those numbers because I don't buy what they're saying. From this standpoint, we know that hybrids are not holding their value. We know that electrics are not holding their value. The people who want to buy this because they're concerned about the planet will go out and pay extra money for it.
Definitely.
But I'm hearing of Nissan Leafs, 2 years old, going down the auction lines at $16,000 to $18,000. They've lost half their value. Mm. So when these guys say, oh, well, if you figure out depreciation, I don't buy what they're saying because based on what I know, the depreciation on hybrid...
This is hybrid, not electric. So the
hybrid
the
even
Leaf
more.
Thing
hybrid
be...
even more so. I mean, look at hybrid sales. And you know, we're in the U.S., so we focus on that. But hybrids don't sell very well in Europe They don't sell well in China. They sell very well in Japan, where there is very lucrative incentives to buy.
Yeah, there are,
there are very few
there are countries in Europe where they sell pretty good. For example, if you go to the Netherlands have a tax system or taxation system that's based on CO2. And every year, to be in the bracket where you pay the least taxes, they deduct it by 10 grams per kilometer. Mm-hmm. So I think at the moment they are at 79 grams per kilometer. If you are in this bracket, you don't pay taxes. And the taxation goes up pretty fast with higher CO2.
It does.
So
And we've seen the same in Denmark with electric cars. Yeah. Electric cars do
Norway.
Very
Norway.
Or Norway, excuse
Norway,
me.
Yeah.
Do very well in Norway for the same thing.
Yeah.
But that's the only way that you can get people to buy these things is you have to have a big penalty to not buy one and a big incentive to buy one. Yeah.
But that's the same still here in the U.S. You have the 7,500 federal tax credit that you get for the electric vehicle. And then depending on which state, which county, whatever, you get more and more. You can get up, I think, to 12,500 is the highest you can get. So if you let's talk golf. If you take a golf, 36,000 electric golf or 35,495 or something, 36,000 because it's easier numbers. And if I now deduct 12,000, I'm only at 24. Mm-hmm. So this makes...
I want to say in Atlanta, you could buy a brand new Leaf for about $18,000.
Yes, correct. Because Atlanta... And the funny thing is Atlanta or Georgia is not a ZEV state. So they are selling those cars and they don't get a single ZEV credit. But the demand because of this tax break is so big that they sell the car there. And we hear the same from our dealers. They want to have the electric Golf down there.
Mm-hmm. So Volkswagen Group with Porsche, I mean, so a lot of hybrid technology is being developed there.
Yeah.
And it seems that if we were to go back 5 years ago, 10 years ago, that there would be greater emphasis, especially by other European companies, including Volkswagen, for diesel technology rather than hybrid technology. But now we look and we begin to see more and more hybrid technology. Why is that?
It depends which hybrid technology. If you the big advantage of plug-in hybrid is you get ZEV credits. So this is why you have to deal with plug-in hybrids anyhow to meet the ZEV mandate. Okay, we are an intermediate volume manufacturer at the moment. We don't have to comply with electric vehicles or plug-in hybrids. We can still comply with partially zero-emission vehicles.
So what does that mean, you're an intermediate?
They're not a full-line manufacturer
in
the U.S.
No, California. California determines what kind of manufacturer you are by the volume you are selling. And with the volume that the Volkswagen Group is selling in California, and they always look back 4, 5, and 6 years, with the volume we are selling in California, we are an intermediate volume manufacturer there. So we are not a large volume manufacturer. The large volume manufacturer have a mandate to achieve a certain percentage of their ZEV credits with the sale of electric vehicles. We don't have this mandate yet. We will get this mandate under the ZEV 2 regulation in model year 2018. Then we are mandated to sell electric vehicles.
Is the plug-in purely a ZEV play? Because it looks like on the luxury side, at least, there might be some demand because you're seeing Panamera sales are like 20% hybrid, plug-in hybrid.
Yeah. The big advantage of those cars is the exemptions you get. This is something that we see. You get your carpool lane stickers and so on and so on. So if somebody that is affluent lives in an area where he needs to commute, let's say somewhere in California, there is a carpool lane there and he has the choice, then of course he picks what brings him faster around town.
A Tesla or a
Panamera plug-in, right?
Yeah, or Panamera plug-in.
Yeah, the only other thing that qualifies are fuel cells and natural gas cars. Yeah. Still can get that sticker too.
Yeah.
So, Oliver, where do you see it all going? I mean, it's so interesting.
Everywhere.
Well, that's what everyone says. I mean, as an automaker, you have to place bets on everything, don't you?
Yeah, that's what we discussed up front. So if you the thing is, development now is so fast. It's not the time anymore. I develop something 4 years, I bring it to market, and then I can produce my engine for 15 years. That time is gone. From what I see, the engine is now like basically like a car. So you bring out an engine after 2-3 years, you have a facelift, and then after another 2-3 years, you already think about the next generation. This is what you see at the moment. It's not only Volkswagen. If you look at other companies, this is what you see in engines. The engines don't stand still anymore, especially European manufacturers. If you look at the engines of Mercedes, BMW, Audi, you see very fast improvements of those engines.
How do you get a return as a manufacturer?
Because the tooling cost has got
to
be.
No, this is you need to install a tooling concept that enables you to manufacture those.
So all CNC, all reprogrammable.
Yeah. If you go into modern engine factories, you don't see transfer anymore.
No,
you see CNC that are combined by a system that moves the part around, but you don't see CNC. You don't see transfer lines anymore. It's all CNC, and then this makes you capable of reacting very fast. Also, if you have shortage in parts, so let's say a line fails in your factory in China, and you have the same line in the U.S. or so, you can ship parts over.
You know, but it's sort of interesting because, you know, you guys for sure remember, doesn't exist anymore, the Livonia engine plant when
Cadillac made its engines.
And they were making the Northstar there, and they were using CNC machines.
Right.
Yeah. But, you know, it just seems to me that it's like a mindset, too.
It's also a question of volume. So, I don't know how many Northstars they produced, but I guess not that many. The North Star was transversal in some Cadillacs, if I remember correct.
Exactly right.
And it was in the ZR1 Corvette in a longitudinal configuration, correct?
I think that's right.
And so they didn't produce that much. So if you are in a volume below 1,000 per day, CNC in the past was a choice to go already. But if you go up in the 2,000 areas, you always went for transfer lines. So, and this break even is going down now.
Well, we've got to take a break here, and we want to give a great shout out to our friends at Firestone.
Hey!
Hey!
Did you have a good nap?
The Firestone Destination LE2. Tough enough to handle anything the road throws at you.
Oops.
And you throw at it. Durable, dependable Firestone tires. Whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
Oliver, we're getting a whole bunch of questions in here from the audience. Let me start out with a comment, mainly from John Warniak, great friend of ours. He says, the traditional big boys in auto feel threatened, as well as the new startups like Tesla and Cruise. But at the same time, Motor City Silicon Valley collaboration is speeding ahead in new and exciting ways that are reinventing the industry. Is this a great time or what? The disruptive competition is great for the industry and will lead to next-gen mobility solutions that are fast and cool, as well as smart and connected. Do you see that?
Yeah.
That this is good. The turmoil is good.
Of course.
Everybody being forced to try new things all the time.
Of course. You see the next push with all the autonomous driving. I don't know, have you been to CES?
Yes.
I haven't been, but I saw all the preparations there. And honestly, comparing CES to Detroit Auto Show, Detroit Auto Show has to pay attention.
They better,
that,
yes.
That they are not, that they still are the first premier event in the year. If I saw what all cars drove there, what manufacturers exhibited, so we had our Audi RS7 there that drove autonomous basically from our electronic research lab in Belmont down to Las Vegas. So and this car wasn't here, on the other booth I saw what they presented in Las Vegas.
Well, Mercedes did make a big deal out of CES with their autonomous car. It was in Detroit, but they didn't really talk much about it. BMW showed their laser headlamps at CES.
Yeah.
They did not bring them to Detroit.
Yeah.
Audi did not bring its... I agree totally with you. The CES show is a threat to the Detroit Auto Show and other auto shows as well.
Yeah. I think it's not a threat to the auto show. The auto show in Detroit will always be. especially if you look in the history how this auto show developed as a showcase for the dealerships and so on and so on. And so it developed into this what it is. And it will still be the family event in downtown Detroit. But the thing of this, the first premier auto show of the year, that's the thing, the title that's right. to be lost here.
Right. No, you're right. It's becoming the technology yeah. showcase.
Which should be here.
Which should be here. I totally agree with you. VRM Chris brings up a topic that I've heard my entire career. What steps are automakers like Volkswagen taking to have regulations be in more harmony with all the major agencies of planet Earth? Why don't we all just agree on the same regulations?
Yeah. You know, it's a very valid point. At the moment, you have these transatlantic trade agreements that are being discussed. And if you are involved in this, it's sometimes kind of stupid what happens there. So one example there, they reached agreement on some things, and then the French put in their veto because they were afraid that the French film industry is threatened by Hollywood. So so this is what's going forth and back there.
My nice favorite, one, folks.
Yeah, my favorite yeah. thing on this is still always the chicken tax. So for those that don't know chicken tax, back in the 50s, the U.S. farmers produced a lot of chicken and they exported this chicken to Europe, especially Germany. So then the German farmers said here, this chicken meat is sold cheaper than we can produce, so we can't survive anymore. Okay, German government puts 25% taxes on chicken meat. So then in return, the U.S. looks, oh, what is Germany bringing into our country that our country can produce? Trucks. So by then, they invented for trucks, definition are in the regulation, but for trucks, they have 25% chicken tax, and it's still valid today. In those years, Volkswagen paid $100 million chicken tax every year Whoa. For the microbuses we brought in.
Whoa.
Not the one with the seats, they don't right. fall under this, but all the ones that were just
cargo vans.
That were cargo vans or flatbeds or so, we paid $100 million a year in chicken tax.
I never knew that.
This is the reason why the new Ford Ranger is not here at the moment,
right.
because built in Thailand. This is the reason why we never thought of bringing our pickup truck here, because being built in Argentina and now Germany. So this is something where he's right. This is something first that needs to be resolved. And then the next step would be the agencies that you get something like, if you have a car, let's say you have a car in Europe that you want to sell here, you get a small volume exemption, and then you can test the car. And then after a while, you have to federalize the car. But the thing is, we have crash standards on both sides of the ocean. They are totally different. But in both sides of the ocean, people survive the accidents if they are in a modern car.
You mentioned autonomous cars. That's got to be the biggest stumbling block, don't you think, is this lack of harmonization around the world?
Yeah, it's one topic. So the autonomous vehicles leave a lot of questions. What happens if an autonomous car is in an accident? Who is to blame? Whom does all these lawyers that make the commercials here in Detroit, whom do they pull to court then? The owner in whose name it's registered, the manufacturer or the software programmer, or whom do you take to court?
I thought actually Volvo had a pretty compelling answer to that today when they were introducing their Drive Me autonomous program. They're basically saying that the autonomous car will have a black box in it, and therefore it will have all of the relevant information germane to the situation, so you'll have facts by which you'll be able to determine blame.
We'll still know, but I think that will get resolved. It'll get resolved in the courts. It'll take a couple of years for sure, because there's going to be the appeal process. Mm. But my argument with autonomy is, if we can save in just the U.S. alone 20,000, 25,000, 30,000 lives a year, why are we having all this argument over who's going to sue whom? You know, let's just get on with it. And the number globally is more like 1 million.
Favorite topic of mine.
Yeah.
There's something else you can do before. Get state inspection in every state.
That's, dream on, Ollie.
No, but honestly, you have states here, you have state inspection. Vehicles that have bolt tires, that have non-working brakes, get pulled off the road and get fixed.
Right.
And you have states where you don't have it. I think one is here.
Yes, it is.
I think you're right.
I know. And I've seen accidents here where cars just collapsed because all rocker panels are corroded out.
Here it is in the winter time.
My personal opinion is those cars should be fixed. And fixing, and the discussion is, I take away the transportation from the very poor people.
Right.
But on the other hand, fixing all those cars or those that are still fixable generates also a lot of business here. Mm-hmm. So to lower this death toll here in the U.S., and if you compare casualties in motor traffic between countries, it's pretty high here in the U.S., I think this would be a help.
Yeah, no, it I'm sure it would be. Abhi from Halifax, Canada says, I want to know what's happening with the VW Phaeton. I mean, you're with Volkswagen, so he's going to ask you. Is it out of production or still
in? No, it's still in production. It's selling like sliced bread in China.
Is that right?
Yeah, I think
really?
More than 70 or 80% of the production go to China.
Wow.
The Chinese love the car. It's one of the reasons why it hasn't been referred. It's in its third facelift by now. Mm-hmm. So it's still the base car. Successor, I guess he knows it from internet and press. Successor is under consideration. Phaeton is still there.
Very interesting.
Phaeton got pulled out of the U.S., that's correct.
Right.
But one of the reasons why it got pulled out, it's not one of the major, but it's also regulations. There were OBD regulations coming in 04, I think, 04 or 05, that this car would not comply. So we would have needed a major redesign of the electrical system of the car to comply with the OBD regulations. This and the sales weren't that strong in the U.S., so this was one of the reasons to pull the cars out. Not to spend that money anymore.
I think it's Glenn from Normal, Illinois, is asking a question about the OPOC engine, the supposed piston one. We're seeing a lot of interest. We've had the guys from Acadis Power here as well. What do you make of all these alternative engines that are being developed?
There's a lot of alternative engines that are being developed. The issue about those engines, Emma, they are always very good on one perspective. So you have engines that are tremendous in fuel economy, but then most of the time they run very lean, so you emit a lot of high NOxes. So this would mean even on a gasoline engine, I would need to adopt some kind of after-treatment for NOxes, so run EGR, maybe even get a filter, or I produce particulates in certain areas, I need then a gasoline particulate filter, and so on. So the problem is really these concepts are all great. There are a lot of great people developing this, but the problem is when you put it all together, you have always one instance that you are missing out. Or there were these, the guys I liked a lot were the guys from Australia that were still developing two strokes for quite a while. They had I once drove their BMW 3 Series with a 3-cylinder. It was tremendous, but the emissions of a two-stroke you can't control.
Right.
So that's the problem. All coming of this together, and if you look at the normal combustion engines, we are now with 100 years of development. So there might be even a concept on its way that is better than the but it needs this time of development, and it needs somebody to develop it over this time to bring it there where the internal combustion is today.
So we're going to have a proliferation of more engines, you were saying earlier, because of the need to change, but it'll still be within basically the parameters that we're familiar with.
Yeah, I would say so. What will change is definitely number of cylinders. This is what we see. I have to make a commercial now for Volkswagen. When we received the Watts 10 best engine for the 1.8 liter in the Golf.
Dave here.
Thank you. Thanks a lot for that.
Yep.
When we received this, this was one of the the topics of the day, that more and more engines that got awards there were four-cylinder and forced induction, mainly turbocharged, except for a few others that received those awards there. So this is what you see. The question is, how far can you go down in cylinders? Ford received, I think, the second time in a row an award for the three-cylinder TSI engine, but it's not selling at the moment in this country in great numbers. But I think it's also because of their offering. They only offer it in the Fiesta as a manual.
And only a manual.
Only a manual. So this limits your customer base. So
it's coming in the Fusion, isn't it?
It's coming in the Fusion soon, yeah. No, not the Fusion. Focus.
Focus, okay.
I wanted to say the Escort, but it's not called the Escort. The Focus. It's coming in the Focus. And if they bring it with the automatic gearbox, they will get more customers for it, definitely. So this is something I want to say. That you will see this, then you will see a lot of technology being put on the engine. You will have, or it's already there, you will have direct injection, you will have forced induction. I would say the majority will be turbochargers. There will be some still using superchargers. You can use a supercharger if you have a very small engine to get rid of the hesitation while takeoff. So if you have the supercharger, but the supercharger, of course, has the disadvantage of the parasitic losses. So you have to make your assessment there if you want to do it. You will see downsizing cylinder-wise, displacement-wise. You will see downsizing there. And then you will see, I think, more stuff like you have currently on hybrid vehicles like Atkinson, so where you have a different combustion system that takes away a bit horsepower, a bit torque, but gives you 2-3 percentages in efficiency. So you will see a lot of this. And with the hybrid, you can operate it mainly in this point of high efficiency. So you will see this a lot. So yeah, that's what you will see.
So what happens with the proliferation for all of the certification? I mean, your job now, I mean, isn't this going to be just a nightmare, deal with all these new engines all the time?
The new engine is not the big nightmare, because if I certify a 4-cylinder turbocharged or a 6-cylinder naturally aspirated, not a big nightmare, same regulations. The problem is, for example, plug-in hybrids. Because the test procedures are so complicated, so you have to run tests where you run out the battery, then you have to refill the battery, you have to come back to what's called the state of charge, and so on and so on. So the tests for those cars get very complicated. The fuel economy testing for those cars is very complicated. That's the issue, that you sell only that few of those cars, but the effort to federalize these cars here is much higher than on the regular cars. That's the big issue here.
Right now, we're going to take a quick break. We've got this promo that I've put together myself for some motor racing, and we're going to get into some other things to discuss. But, Ben, let's run that promo.
Sunday, it's the Rock'em Sock'em Stock Car Demolition Derby. You won't want to miss any of the action as a jam-packed field of 42 cars converge in a melee of bumping, bashing, crunching, and crashing. All at 200 miles an hour. And the action doesn't end with the checkered flag. No! That's when the fist fighting begins! Double-barreled action brought to you in high-def slow-mo. Funnier than Curly Larry and Mo. This Sunday at the Daytona 500.
I'm sorry, I'm a motor racing fan, and I've loved NASCAR since I was a little kid, but to me it's just becoming this, the Worldwide Wrestling Federation. You know, it's just... I don't know.
So explain restrictor plates to us, since you're a powertrain guy.
A restrictor plate?
For the restrictor plate courses that they're running NASCAR, like Daytona.
Simple?
Yeah.
It's basically a hole somewhere that limits your flow of air.
That's a plate.
It's a plate.
With a hole drilled in it.
With a hole.
Actually, four holes.
Four holes, because...
Four barrel carb.
They don't run carbs anymore.
Well,
there's the
right.
Big invention in NASCAR now to switch to fuel injection.
That's right.
That's why if I would have made this commercial, I would have made more fun of their technology.
My favorite story about restrictor plates goes actually back to a race at the Michigan International Speedway, and there was a guy named, and I'm pretty sure I got this right, Cuckoo Marlin. Cuckoo Marlin went through tech inspection, and they saw his restrictor plate under the carburetor. They measured it. Everything was right. And about three laps into the race, Cuckoo, who was always a back marker, races to the front, goes on. I can't remember if he won the race or finished way, 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 you know, top three or four like he never, ever did in his life. And they said, come on into tech inspection after the race. And what they found out is that his restrictor plate – had been made out of wax.
Oh.
It melted like that. But anyway, hey, a programming note before we get into some of the other discussion. We're going to move the time that we do the live version of After Hours. We're starting on March 5th, first Thursday in March, we're going to move this to 3 p.m. Eastern Time, not the 6 p.m. that we've been doing. And we need to do that from a production standpoint to have the right amount of staff to be able to put this show out. So we'll be warning you in a couple of more times before that happens. But anyway, we're going to be moving to 3 p.m.
Do you rename the show then?
No,
no. In between hours? Or?
In between. Before or after hours. Oh,
before or after hours.
Hey, so I'm curious, what do you guys think of what Apple is up to? I mean, here we got this word that they've got this team allegedly of 200 people working on supposedly an electric car. What do you guys make of this?
I'm amazed at how many people want to get in the auto business because it's always been so hard. You know, mm-hmm. So it's tough to do. It's not a darling of Wall Street unless you're Tesla. So, yeah, it's like, why are you doing this?
I don't think they want to get in the auto business. I think this is basically Apple's move whereby they're looking up the street at Google, mm-hmm. okay? Mm-hmm. So the Google guys in Mountain View are doing what they're doing, and they're basically saying, you know what? We've got to get technology that is better than what they have. Mm-hmm. Because think about this. We're talking about autonomous cars, right? So what do you do when you're in an autonomous car? Well, you begin to consume other things, other media. You begin to do other things. What does Apple do, right? They're going to sell you books. They're going to sell you movies. They're going to sell you music.
But we already have this. You have Mirrorlink. With Mirrorlink, you get all the content off your iPhone. You can get on your screen already. Just make the screen a bit bigger, and you have it. So that I think that's already there. I'm wondering what they do, but I think they also look up. They do not only look up to Google. They also look at Tesla, and they see what they are doing. And I think they do parts of this with 200 people. I don't know if you can build a
car. But going to 1,000.
Yeah, I don't know what they are doing. So maybe we should all just apply and see what the interview questions
There's
are.
That's a good idea.
That we know what they're up to.
Yeah.
But I think they are looking into, I think they want to offer integration to OEMs. I think this is more my idea.
So what would this be? So basically they'd come to Volkswagen and do what?
This is your autonomous driving module.
And this is something you would put in a car, or is it the entire...
You would put in a car.
Right.
Okay, so you'd have...
With Google, is what you're saying.
Yeah, so this is your autonomous... So basically, if you look at a car today, you have electric power steering, so it's pretty easy to steer a car automatically. You have these lane assist things that see where you are already. You have your GPS, you know where the roads are. So putting all this together into a module that basically gives you a defined output what the car needs to do at this moment, I think this is what they do. And then, of course, picking up your ideas, adding all their content into it. I that's my personal opinion, what they're into. I doubt they build a car.
I just can't imagine that. I mean, and you know, but the sort of thing that strikes me is that, you know, here in Detroit, car companies want to make their own head units and screens, and they're going to turn that over to Apple?
Yeah. Well, hold on. We hold these thoughts because we're going to take another quick commercial break right now. This time, a real commercial break, because we got to give a shout out to our good friends at Henkel.
A little chemistry goes a long way, especially when it comes to vehicle development. From enabling the use of alternate materials to withstanding extreme vehicle environments, Henkel's adhesive, sealants, and surface technologies provide solutions for every vehicle segment. Come see for yourself. Our Detroit area headquarters offers 12 research and development and testing laboratories with the ability to do full-range testing and validation on actual vehicle parts. Sign up to tour our labs at henkelna.com/tour.
Okay, back to Apple. Because what I think is interesting is they don't make anything. They never have made anything, pretty much. They design everything, they develop it, they prove it, and then they go out to contract manufacturers.
Although they used to, they used to build the Max.
Yeah. Okay.
When they first started on, and they had a factory.
Okay. 2000, I think Max were built
In Fremont.
Yeah. Fremont.
And then,
It was funny. Steve Jobs' definition of a flexible manufacturing facility was a D10 Caterpillar tractor. He would just level the factory and build a new one.
But in any case, you know, there was a report, supposedly, that Apple flew out to go visit Magna Steyr in Austria. So I don't know, is that just trying to create disinformation?
Yeah, it's probably just trying to prop up their stock or something. Is it trying to?
I don't think they have a problem there.
Yeah, well, you know, it could always go higher, right?
Magna Steyr wanted to be in the car business forever. They were in the bidding process for Chrysler.
Right.
They were in the bidding process for Opel.
Right.
So Magna Steyr wants to be a car manufacturer.
They do.
But more than a contract manufacturer?
Yeah, they wanted to design and
It sort of seems like, okay, if you make most of your money supplying car companies, how receptive would car companies be to buying your parts if you're a competitive manufacturer with them?
Yeah, that's always been the question. Can you be a supplier and a car company?
Right.
And no one's answered that because no one's tried it.
Right, because it doesn't seem to be a very good plan to me.
Yeah.
I could see Apple absolutely designing their own electric car, but I think you're right. I think they're worried about Google becoming the dominant force in autonomy and all the data that goes in and out of the car, not just to make a drive down the road, but what the passengers, the people inside the car are doing. You know, Google wants to dominate that.
Isn't there the story that Apple tried with the iPhone 6 or somewhere, or iPad 2 or whatever, to have their own navigation system that tremendously failed, and now you have Google Maps back on it?
Well, no, when they came out with their last operating system, that the map thing was a disaster. They fired that guy who was in charge of that part of the business, and they've got a new map. So it's... they've taken care of that problem.
Yeah, but still everybody uses Google Maps, or?
Right.
Google bought Waze recently, if I'm correct?
Yes.
So Google bought Waze.
Right.
And I know my wife always uses the iPhone for navigation, and she always uses Google. She doesn't use what's built into the Apple.
Mm-hmm.
She uses Google for it, or she uses Waze, but by now it's the same. So so she uses this, and maybe it's in that direction.
Could be. Hey, jumping topics here. I was knocked out. In fact, Oliver and I were talking before the show started about this new Kia concept station wagon, the Sports Space. And so my question is, it's a station wagon. I think it looks sensational. But all automotive journalists love station wagons, and especially if they've got diesels and manual transmissions. But my question to you guys is... could wagons catch on again in the U.S. market?
I saw a CTS wagon yesterday. It looked sensational.
But it didn't sell in any big volume. And I still love the Dodge Magnum from a few years back. I thought that was a good-looking car, especially I saw a couple of tricked-out ones with some really nice wheels and the like, and I thought they would look fantastic. They didn't really sell all that well. Could wagons make a comeback?
You know, the thought that struck me when I saw that, you're starting to see all these they call them CUVs, but they're really kind of muscled-up hatchbacks, you know, and it wouldn't take much. You know, you see those around for a little while that you just kind of stretch it out, and you have this kind of aggressive-looking station wagon. Mm. You know, it just seems like that might be the natural evolution of where things go.
I think everything possible within a show car has been built as a crossover by now.
Mm-hmm.
So, right. And there weren't a lot of wagon show cars in recent times. So I think that this is what you see there that's going there. Of course, for me, being the European, I like station wagons.
Sure, definitely. Because Europe is the last market where wagons really go through any success.
If I look at European Passat, it's up sometimes up to 80% wagons, 20% sedans.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And this Kia, it seemed to have a fairly low roof line. And, you know, in this whole CUV thing, it seems that, you know, they all have higher H points, so people have better visibility, so that would counter that.
But now we're seeing a change, right? You know, so if you see the BMW X6, it's, you know, a kissing cousin to the X5, but the X5 is more upright and formal. And everyone's trying to design their vehicle, their four-door vehicle, whether it's a sedan, a CUV, or an SUV, to look like a coupe. And I thought that was kind of interesting about this Kia sports space, is it's got that same sort of station wagon, but almost starting to get fastback, almost.
Yeah, but it's not sloping that much in the roofline than others.
No, it seemed...
It seemed pretty square in the rear. Yeah.
I mean, once you buy these coupe-y things and you realize there's not much cargo room, then you're going to want to gravitate to the longer back.
It didn't work out for the ZDX, so. Yeah.
I had a Passat CC once as a company car. Mm-hmm. Looks cool, but that's everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
maybe wagons will not catch on?
Well, see, but again, you get back to the point. I mean, so remember several years ago at the Detroit show when we saw the Chevy Nomad concept, remember? We were knocked out by that.
All us automotive journalists just love that. So
why don't they catch on?
Because I think part of it is what Dave says. I mean, people are looking for packaging utility, and when you get right down to it, station wagons aren't all that great.
Well, you know, I think part of
the thing... But then why didn't the minivan stay? Why is now everybody switching? If you talk packaging, the minivan is the best car available.
Sure. Right.
Period.
But it has a stigma.
That's all.
You know, you're the minivan mom or the minivan dad, and people don't like it.
Yeah, and that's the whole thing. And you just
in fact, that's why station wagons, certainly in the U.S., lost it, because all us baby boomers who grew up in station wagons, and I sure did, in a big family, we didn't want to buy the car that our parents had driven us around in. We didn't want that at all.
We were afraid of vinyl wood on the side.
We had a number of wagons with, right.
See, but you don't know that back when we were growing up, that station wagons had rear-facing
seats. No, I know. We had
seats.
We had those in Europe as well.
Really?
Yeah, the Mercedes E-Class had these rear-facing seats.
Mm-hmm. So that's a NHTSA.
Look, I learned how to drive in the station.
Tesla has the same. Tesla Model S has a rear-facing third row as an option.
It does.
Because
that's right.
Elon Musk has the four kids, and one of the criteria for his cars is the four kids need to fit in. So it has the rear-facing.
Some people get car sickness from looking out the back. Mm-hmm. It's like disconcerting to what they're used to. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I think... It'll be interesting to see the public reaction to this Kia car and see maybe if wagons could ever catch on again.
10 years from now, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Could be.
I see we have the Jetta sports wagon, soon the Golf sports wagon. The segment size for this car has stayed the same over years.
Here everywhere?
In the U.S. Yeah. In the U.S. So the question is, how do you define wagon? For me, there are a lot of cars that are wagon-ish, but sell a bunch load, especially if I look up to Subaru. The Subaru cars, they are a bit raised, so we have the higher point, better visibility. Then the Subarus have kind of, if you look at them from a designer's perspective, they look kind of odd because they have a very huge glass house. Mm-hmm. So the windows are pretty big, but what do you get? Good visibility. So if maybe in this direction, if you really take the SUVs a bit down and make them in this direction, you can see this.
And weren't you reporting, John, that Peugeot has gotten some sales bump of late, and it has a lot to do with their crossover vehicle?
Well, they just redesigned the 208, which is a small B-class car, which is their best-selling car. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure of any crossover.
Don't they have crossover?
It's like I have no idea about you. I lived here too long. Sorry.
How many years you lived here?
3 years.
Yeah. It's too long?
That's too long.
Hey, things are changing.
I haven't
quick.
Paid any attention to the European car market.
No. Well, what do you guys make, too, at the other end of the spectrum? Rolls-Royce now going to come out with an SUV.
Yeah, but Bentley is coming out with an SUV. Mm-hmm. Other luxury manufacturers are coming out with an SUV.
I think everybody probably looked at Porsche with the Cayenne and went, if Porsche can sell SUVs.
I recently
SUVs.
Was at an event of Chrysler where they showed some future plans. Hmm. There was a D SUV in the Jeep brand. So everybody's looking there.
I mean, the purists are critical, but it's where the market is. Yeah. I mean, you wouldn't survive as Bentley if you don't have one of these.
Yeah, even Jaguar is going to do a crossover, even though the brand has got Land Rover, which was supposedly, that original plan was, you guys take care of that, we'll take care of passenger cars. And you're right, Dave, that's where the market's
going.
And
it's even easy for them. Just take a Land Rover and make it a Jaguar. Once you have the platform.
Does it get to a point, though, that everyone has one and therefore the cachet is completely gone and therefore people say, well, I want to do something else? I mean,
that's when station wagons will make a comeback.
There we go. No, but I mean, if you think about it.
Do we get D-class or E-class station wagons then as a replacement for those?
Maybe both.
Yeah.
Because, couldn't you argue that one of the reasons why Tesla has become so successful, especially where it is successful in California, is, I mean, not only the carpool lanes, but the fact that it is something different and you're able to buy something. Yeah. And when, you know, everybody has one that lives in Atherton or something, then nobody's going to buy one, right?
On those cars, it's extreme where you see this, but it's on every car. When you launch a new car, the first year you sell a lot, then your sales decline, then you do your facelift, you sell a bit more, and then they decline again, and then you have to bring a new one. So it's the same story everywhere. As long as it's new, it's selling good.
Mm-hmm.
It's like when sedans were bad, right? We didn't buy sedans, and then somebody decided that looked like a luxury car, and then everybody wanted like a notchback sedan, right? Mm.
It's amazing how... To your point, Oliver, you've got to constantly be coming out with fresh new stuff. That's what people want. And look, this is why the successful department stores change their window displays. Mm-hmm. You know, if you leave the same one, it doesn't matter how good it is, it just becomes commonplace.
But
you've got to stand out.
Are there still successful department stores?
Not so much in the U.S.
Amazon.
Anymore. Nordstrom's, there's a
Amazon
few
and
left.
Amazon eBay, or?
Right.
See, but this makes me wonder, though. I mean, again, and this is like, a bunch of old guys sitting around talking here, but, in the old days when the windows of dealerships would be covered because there was going to be a new car being introduced and everybody'd wait for that car to come out. And now the changes are just so frequent that it is difficult
to... And you see it 15 weeks before it's in the dealership, at the auto show, or in the internet.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not new anymore. I remember this. My parents, they always got invited when there was a new Mercedes, when there was a new BMW, because my dad always drove those cars. We always got those invites, the big party,
right?
A tarp over the car, then the tarp got pulled back, and so on. It was a tremendous event. Doesn't happen anymore.
And you think about that, though. I mean, what does Apple do when they're coming out with a new iPhone? It's not out there. They hold a big event.
Yeah.
There it is.
Yeah. Right.
And then you can go to your store tomorrow and start buying them. You know what I mean? And maybe that's what the car companies need to learn from Apple.
Well,
that to
maybe go back.
If you talk about
keep it all secret when you develop a new car, place it in all the dealerships, and then one day now it's getting launched. You think that's still possible today?
No,
with all
not
the
at all.
Internet and smartphones with.
But it's not even that. It's the quantity of product. If you go back to the mid-1950s and look at Chevrolet, the most popular brand in the United States, they had three separate models. They had the Chevrolet, and there was a two-door, a four-door, a convertible, and a wagon. They had the Nomad, and they had the Corvette. And that was it. I think they probably have 14 truck models today and probably 10 car models today. And you've got to be constantly refreshing these things or completely redesigning them. And so Apple can hold back for a few years and put the wrapping on the windows of the dealership, so to speak, and the tarp over it and pull it off, and everybody will stand in line to buy it. But if they had to do this multiple launches throughout the year, I don't think it would work at all. I think it's just the frequency.
If you look at the car market, isn't it you need four cars? Mainly, if you want to be a successful brand, let's not luxury, but volume. You need your midsize sedan, your midsize SUV. You need your compact sedan, your compact SUV. Those are the four cars that you should have. So once you have four cars, you have at least something new in the dealership every year. If you have a 6-7 year model cycle, you have a facelift and so on. I think that's mainly what you need. Everything else is to really get appetite, to get people in the dealership, to get them in, see, okay, this new car is maybe not for me, but let's go to the back to the Chevy example. I go home with a Malibu or the whatever. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you have the trucks on top, but this... Mm-hmm.
So conceivably, you could do that. You could have the surprise, here it is, buy it.
Yeah.
Because you have the four. So each year, you're rolling out a new one. Mm-hmm.
But nobody will do that. They don't do that. I would modify slightly what you say. I think you just need small, medium, and large. Passenger car and crossover / SUV.
Do we need small?
Do you need small?
Subcompact or compact as small?
Well, we can argue about what small is, right. But I think with today's cars, it's easy enough to... And, you know, the MQB platform allows a lot definitely. Of that flexibility.
Yeah.
And, you know, where you've got most of the cost baked into... everything between the front axle and the dashboard.
Yeah.
You know, that's where your cost
and that has to stay the same overall cost.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. But I would say that most car companies, most, could get away with small, medium, and large, mm-hmm. passenger car version, and as crossover.
CUV, version. SUV, whatever, right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, then you can talk commercial, you know, pickups and commercial vans and the like.
One thing I want to ask you, so I've been having this in this book for months now. Volkswagen Group is the number one R&D spender in the world, more than anybody.
Yeah.
What are you guys spending all that money on? I mean, you're spending more than Samsung, Intel, Microsoft, Roche, Novartis. Toyota's number 7. You guys are number 1 by a wide margin. Mm-hmm. General Motors, 11. Daimler 12, Ford 15, Honda 17. You guys number 1 mm-hmm. for the second year in a row. Mm-hmm. Where's it all go?
Do you have the same for production?
Mm-mm.
If you
R&D.
Huh? Yeah,
R&D.
But it's related. If you would look into the depth of production on a Volkswagen car compared to other cars, we have the really most depth of in-house production. And if you produce in-house, you develop in-house.
So you mean vertical integration?
Right.
Yeah. We do, just an example, we do fuel tanks in-house. We do wheels in-house. We do dashboards in-house. We do seats in-house. Then if, now going back to my expertise, powertrains, we do flywheels in-house. We do valve guides in-house. We do rockers in-house. So this is we do a lot of stuff in-house that is bought at other companies.
Right.
So the percentage of really in-house manufacturing is a lot higher than at a lot of competitors, and you need to develop the stuff.
Hmm.
Okay, now you can argue a valve guide. You don't need to develop a lot on a valve guide. It's bronze, it's round, and it varies a bit in diameter and length. Yeah, you're correct. That's not the big thing, but a dashboard is something where you develop a lot. And if you produce it in-house, and all these people that develop the stuff are counted towards R&D.
Hmm. I think it's important to point out that Volkswagen employs more people than any other car company in the world by a wide margin.
Yeah.
VW has more employees than 2 times General Motors.
Wow.
We are close to 600,000, yeah.
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 And so to Oliver's point, it has so many different brands, mm-hmm. and they have a very clear brand identity between them and that vertical integration. Mm. And the key, I think, in all this is, because when I point this out to U.S. automotive executives, they're floored by how many employees Volkswagen has. Mm-hmm. And yet Volkswagen's profit margins are far greater than the guys that have far fewer employees. So, you know...
Except for Toyota.
Except for Toyota. But Toyota's got quite a few employees, too. They're the second highest in the business. So just, you know, the MBA think is, oh, you got to get rid of headcount to be able to make margins. And what Volkswagen has proven is that, no, you can have twice as many employees and a little bit more volume and still make whopping big profit margins.
But it also has its risks. The break, we know this from competitive analysis, the break-even point for our factories is higher as with competitors. But once you reach it, the profit is higher.
Right.
So this is something, I think it's a McKinsey study. It's a McKinsey study where they compare factories, and there you can see this.
Right. But that's a danger where you start to cherry pick things and analyze, well, you know, let's look at the factory and the break even and yada, da, da, da. But that's the same argument of saying, why should I make something in-house? I'll buy it from somebody. Now I don't have to put up the capital investment to make it. Mm-hmm. But by the same token, that supplier that's making it for you, they want a profit margin, and they're going to keep that. So if you can do it efficiently, making it in-house is more profitable.
And the big issue is if you buy it, every supplier has kind of a platform strategy as well. So if I buy a seat, it's something I have no clue about, so I will mostly talk rubbish now. But nevertheless, so if you buy a seat, if I would be a seat manufacturer, I would try to have as few different steel components that go in my seat as possible. And even foams, I would try to reduce as to the foams. So if now I'm the car manufacturer, I come to seat manufacturer and say, please build me a seat. I get most likely the same steel as my competitor next door. So if I build my seat now myself, and I say, okay, maybe I should make the seat a bit lower. Maybe I can shave 2 centimeters or close to an inch out of this seat and get it a bit closer to the floor. If I then, with this supplier, he has to design the own seat for me. He has to do it. So costs go up. I have to pay his R&D expenses and so on and so on. If I build the seat myself, I can decide this right from the beginning.
Yep. And to go back to the powertrain proliferation, does making things in-house allow you guys to go faster to make changes more quickly than you otherwise would be able to if you had to go to the market and say, I need a new valve seat or...
Yeah, valve guides, we make seats, we don't make seats.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry.
But
maybe you can put that on your checklist.
But it gives you really greater flexibility. Mm-hmm. Changes can be made pretty fast. Mm-hmm. And especially, we talked about this in the beginning, if you really have a CNC production system, CNC based on your engine side, it gives you great flexibility. Mm-hmm. If you need to change a position of a boss or whatever, the same thing in-house. We have foundries in-house. Most of our aluminum comes from in-house foundries, and we have even magnesium foundries in-house. So the gearbox factory in Kassel has a huge magnesium foundry. So this also gives you, and it gives you a hand over your quality, because if you look quality recalls, it's most of the time supplier parts. Mm-hmm. It's most of the time supplier parts. It's not what you do in house, and if you go in this, if you have a control over a longer part of the whole supply chain, you can. You can tailor it better to your demands.
Hmm. Very interesting. So we're maybe going to go full circle here, back to Henry Ford's vision of raw materials coming in one end of the complex and cars going out the other.
But that's you know where Ferdinand Porsche was in the 30s pretty often.
Mm-hmm. In Dearborn.
Yeah, in Dearborn, and where he got his ideas from. Basically, the original Volkswagen factory is a better copy of Dearborn.
Very interesting. I never knew that.
If you read the stories, Henry Ford and Ferdinand Porsche were pretty close friends. Porsche was here pretty often before he designed the factory for the Volkswagen Beetle. And the idea of the Beetle factory is the same as Dearborn. Basically, get steel and sand in and whatever you need for tires. I think they even built tires in Dearborn for a while.
They did.
And get whole vehicles out. And it was the same idea for the first Volkswagen factory.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
It was placed in a strategic point where you had the rail, where you had a waterway, where you had the autobahns, where the crossing of the autobahns was. Okay, the second one was never built there, but that's other circumstances. So they placed it strategically there so they could get all the material there and then could build the cars there.
Hmm. Real good. Well, that, we ought to wrap it up. Oliver Schmidt, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Great having you back here again. Great discussion. Very good insight.
Thanks a lot.
And you got to come back sometime when you're in town, when you're
Yeah, okay.
Visiting from Germany.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Open door.
Okay,
open
thanks.
Door invitation.
Thanks a lot.
Dave Zoya, we'll great having you though, here. So.
Yeah. Thanks, great to be here.
It'll be at 3 p.m., not 6, okay. just so you know.
Yeah, but if I come over, I'm more jet-lagged then, so at 3 p.m. is good then.
Yeah, okay. That's right.
Okay, that's fine.
Gary, good seeing you.
See you next week.
Will do. Okay, I want to thank everybody for having tuned in.
Okay.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Henkel. Excellence is our passion.
Starting March 5th, Autoline After Hours moves its live broadcast time to 3 p.m. Eastern Time and every Thursday. Again, that's March 5th at 3 p.m. Detroit time for Autoline After Hours. Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.